From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Cuts to Medicaid and ACA subsidies are coming, and there appears to be no upside to the situation.
It is definitely a big concern for practices, for hospitals.
Also this week, we'll have an update on Florida's property tax issue, along with the mounting pressure on lawmakers from the governor to perhaps get rid of it altogether.
I don't think a lot of these guys would want to vote the wrong way then.
We'll also get into some of the real controversy involving celebrated youth influencer Charlie Kirk, and we'll hear about a partial rollback of a law passed last year to discourage whistleblowing in the public sector. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Big changes are coming for healthcare in Florida, from the looming cuts to Medicaid to the expiration of enhanced tax credits for Affordable Care Act plans. WUSF's Megan Bowman talked with a Tampa physician about what it means for Floridians.
Changes to Medicaid and the ACA will put strain on hospitals, leading to reduced services and more people using emergency rooms. Access to some services, like pregnancy care or mental health treatment, will likely be affected. Tampa Bay area physician Jennifer Caputo-Seidler helps break down how everything may impact Floridians. So what does this new law, the Big Beautiful Bill, do to Medicaid in Florida?
We know that Medicaid services are going to decrease. What we don't know is which ones. Medicaid covers a lot of children. Medicaid covers a lot of pregnancies. Medicaid covers long-term care. Medicaid does a lot of mental health care and substance use disorder care. All of those things are areas where we could see cuts. The details, we don't know yet.
I know that the enhanced tax credits are expiring and then we have Medicaid, but they're separate and kind of coincidental that it's happening at the same time. Can you sort of break down what that'll look like in the state?
The fact that all of these things are happening, it just amplifies it, because Medicaid and the ACA, these were all developed as the safety net. Out of sheer coincidence, at the end of this year, the subsidies for affordable care plans are expiring. That is going to have huge impact come January 1st, because a lot of those plans that allowed people who make too much money to be on Medicaid and who aren't offered insurance from their employer, and who otherwise were unable to afford insurance as an individual or as a family, their plans are going to become unaffordable.
Is this changing how doctors are going to run their practices?
It is definitely a big concern for practices, for hospitals, because we know we're going to be bringing in less money, which means we're going to be able to offer less services to our patients. It is going to be hard to keep up with giving people the standard of care.
And how's it impacting like emergency services or labor and delivery units?
So emergency services will definitely be impacted, because the emergency room is always a place you can go and get care and not get turned away. When people start losing coverage, it's going to be hard to get in to go see a primary care doctor and have things taken care of proactively, unless you have a lot of cash on hand to pay for those things, which, again, most people don't have that right now. That means emergency room wait times go up, because all of the emergencies, the people having heart attacks and strokes and car accidents, don't stop. But now you also have people who are just looking to get their high blood pressure taken care of. It's also way more expensive to get care in the emergency room than to get care in a primary care or specialist office. So it becomes a higher cost to the system overall to take care of people when we put them in that position.
And tell me a little bit too about those folks who say, well, I've got insurance through my employer, so I'm fine.
Those people, I think, will be the least impacted, but it's not going to be zero impact, because the system itself is being strained. Even if you have good insurance, those wait times are going to go up when you call to say, hey, I need to see a neurologist. It's going to be hard for you to find somebody. If you find yourself in an emergency situation, you're going to be sitting in that same ER waiting room for 6, 8, 10 plus hours because people have gone there as their last resort. So probably financially, people won't see an impact, but just in terms of access and care, everyone's going to be affected.
That's Tampa Bay area physician Jennifer Caputo-Seidler. I'm Megan Bowman in Tampa.
Governor Ron DeSantis is floating the idea of a special legislative session to cut property taxes if state lawmakers don't take quick action. We get more on that story from Douglas Soule.
Florida House lawmakers are already trying to figure out how to reduce the property tax. The plan is to vote on something during the 2026 legislative session, which voters would then have to approve during next year's election. Governor Ron DeSantis is upping the pressure. He's suggesting a special session if the legislature does not get it done.
We could potentially have a special session on property tax right in the middle of the Republican primary season in July or August. Imagine that. I don't think a lot of these guys would want to vote the wrong way then.
DeSantis says the property tax is too expensive, and he disagrees with people having to pay it.
I want to see something big enacted. That's the whole goal.
While the governor can call a special session, it's ultimately up to the House and Senate to pass legislation during one. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
Coming up on Capitol Report, last year a new Florida law stripped away a number of whistleblower protections, but that could change during the 2026 lawmaking session, although the sponsor says it won't mean open season on government officials.
We don't want to have people report things to the Commission on Ethics just for political reasons or just for a grudge match.
We'll have a nuanced conversation about the life and death of Charlie Kirk.
Honor his legacy by inviting into the arena those voices of dissent right now.
Let's say your business depends on an Instagram presence, which suddenly gets shut down for no legit reason.
I mean, I don't exist. I cannot even anything. I don't, username not found.
And we'll recall the legacy and the words of Jane Goodall.
There can be peace if I remind people that the power of love is stronger than the love of power.
A proposed state law would enact stronger protections for whistleblowers who work for state or local governments. Tristan Wood reports it comes after a bill passed in 2024, which took away the ability to file complaints anonymously.
Legislation passed last year limited the length of ethics investigations, required sworn affidavits to launch complaints, and banned secondhand knowledge from being used in certain investigations. Zephyr Hills Republican Senator Danny Burgess argued on the Senate floor that the changes were needed to keep ethics commissions from being used for political purposes.
Somebody could just call a tip line hotline, pick up the phone and say, hey, this person's doing X, Y, and Z, hang up the phone, and then immediately maybe call the media and tip that off that a complaint was made, and then the whole thing spirals out of control.
The problem with that is it kind of tipped the canoe the other direction.
Pensacola Republican Senator Don Gates says the law has resulted in a chilling effect that's made people hesitant to file complaints. He's behind a bill filed for the upcoming session that he hopes will help people feel confident in coming forward when they see wrongdoing.
Because we don't want to provide any disincentive to someone who observes something that's unethical, that sees something and has evidence of something unethical. We don't want them to have any disincentive to reporting it to the Commission on Ethics, just like we don't want to have people report things to the Commission on Ethics just for political reasons or just for a grudge match.
The bill would allow anyone wronged after filing a complaint to have their position reinstated, back pay and benefits compensated, and more. Integrity Florida is one of the groups that opposed the 2024 law. Ben Wilcox, the group's research director, says Gates's legislation is a step in the right direction.
Giving whistleblower status to people within government who file ethics complaints is just common sense, basically. It protects the person who's filing the whistleblower complaint from being retaliated against by their boss. it's a good bill, and it's much needed.
Ultimately, Wilcox believes more needs to be done in terms of Florida ethics because he views that 2024 bill as a drastic hindrance to accountability in Florida.
I don't think the people of Florida want the Florida Commission on Ethics to not be able to be aggressive in investigating violations of our ethics laws.
It's unclear at this point whether legislative leadership will move forward with this bill when session starts in January. I'm Tristan Wood.
Democratic gubernatorial candidate David Jolly is traveling the state in the run-up to next year's election. Free speech is one of the issues on his mind following the murder of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. On the Deeper Dive with Derek Hamm podcast, Jolly revealed how Kirk's assassination prompted him to assess whether he wanted to remain in the race for governor. Here's an excerpt.
His assassination was such a significant moment. You know, I don't, no pun intended to say turning point, but I really do think this is kind of a turning point. His death represents some sort of a significant moment in the political arc here of where we're at as a nation. We're seeing a crackdown on speech that's unbelievable.
It's vicious.
I mean, as a journalist, you know, I'm watching this and it's happening in rapid fire so quickly that, you know, it's now even just quoting his own words is, I mean, what happened to, like, we don't do cancel culture?
I worry in this moment how we get out of it. And I think it's okay to recognize the uncertainty of it. I think those who think the answers are easy are overlooking the earnest convictions on all sides of this, mm-hmm. the feeling of right and self-righteousness. Mm-hmm. I worry about the constitutional violations that we are seeing from government right now, cracking down on speech, our own attorney general having to admit that she didn't understand the constitutional protections that should be allowed for speech when she said they're going to come after hate speech. Hate speech isn't unconstitutional. If so, a lot of people would be in jail on all sides of this debate right now.
Skokie, Illinois, that's, my friends.
That's right.
Skokie, Illinois.
Here's what I would offer.
Before your people were born, before Charlie Kirk was born, but, you know, that's...
Yeah, there's a lot of healing that needs to happen, and I don't know that one single election or a candidate emerges to heal this, but here's what I would say, and it is most important to my Republican friends to hear this. If my Republican friends truly wish to honor the legacy of someone that they revere in Charlie Kirk, they should welcome all voices into the public arena, not crack down on it. Because Charlie's mission...
It was his shtick.
That was his shtick if you listen to Republicans. Now, I would also ask my Republican friends to earnestly try to understand how hurtful some of Charlie Kirk's words.
Yeah, I think that we have
people.
To put it in the context,
but,
you know.
But the only way to finally understand that is to honor his legacy by inviting into the arena those voices of dissent right now who are trying to tell you why they disagree with the direction the country's taking. I worry about what Republicans are doing right now in the aftermath of the assassination.
What do you think the impact, do you think that his death, I mean, it's early now, we're creeping up to just a year away from the general election. Yeah. It seems amazing to me that we're that close. But right now, as we hear today, what impact do you think his death and the reaction to it will have on the 2026 election here in Florida?
My fear is more violence. My fear is more violence. And my fear, based on what we're seeing at the hands of government, is more investigations into political candidates. If they are willing to crack down on media, if they are willing to crack down on private companies and private employees, I'm afraid they're also going to start to crack down on candidates for speech. That's the trend line. That's one of my fears. Now, if your question is getting to what is the political impact, I think it's too early. Mm-hmm. I think it's too early. My concern, my real concern, as I mentioned earlier, I don't believe a single election fixes this. I don't think a candidate emerges that heals this. Ultimately, this is going to be on us, how we figure it out. Now, I would say we have had moments of uncertainty before in American history where we take a step out not knowing where it's going to lead us. And it's okay to embrace that uncertainty, but I think we always have to return to our values. What are the values that we should hold and we do hold? And again, to my friends on the right, if one of those values is free speech, then embrace that right now. Embrace free speech for everybody. if there is a value that the Constitution should provide protections or that the economy should work for everyone, that religious freedom is important, what are those values that we can agree on in a moment of uncertainty and step out together, commit to condemning violence and hate on all sides, try to quiet those voices as John McCain famously did at a town hall, don't excite them and amplify them and fuel them. We have to do that together. I would say it's too early for us to be able to see that.
Right, sure. Now,
but that has to be where this ends up.
You're a candidate. You have two young children. Are you concerned about your own safety as you travel around a state this size where people are so divided at this time?
Have I considered dropping out of the race? Yes.
Before or after his?
After. Is that an honest, raw conversation my wife and I have?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. I'm in this race in part because, as I once told my daughter, if you have a chance to change the world, you take it. And I believe we have a chance to change the direction of Florida. And if we do that, it will be an earthquake in American politics, a wake-up in American politics.
That was Democratic gubernatorial candidate David Jolly on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. Many business owners rely on Instagram to get their word out about their products and services. Tom Hudson brings us the story of a realtor who was locked out of her account for almost 3 months and is still waiting for an apology.
Love it or hate it, social media is a fact of life and a way of business. Gigi Coloma figures 80% of her income as a realtor in South Florida came through her Instagram account. And then she was kicked off the platform this summer with no warning, accused of an ugly violation of Instagram's rules. This is her story of username not found. That's what her customers saw for months as she hoped to clear her name and recover her reputation.
My name is Gisela Coloma, and I'm in real estate. I also do short-term rentals for the same company. I was born and raised in Peru. We're a family of four girls. One by one, as soon as we graduated high school, we started immigrating to Miami, and I was number three. A lot of clients contact me through DM on Instagram because a company that I work for, they tag, they do a lot of content, we repost it. That's how they find who and what agent works for the company and send me a direct message. I was actively on Instagram on my birthday dinner. My girlfriends reposted as a group. And when I went to repost, I didn't have access to my account. I got an email from Instagram saying that my account was not following the community guidelines. And the reason was the child exploitation, nudity, sexual exploitation. At the beginning, I thought somebody had reported me, and I said, I must have a hater that hates me that much that accused me of being a pedophile. They shut me down immediately. They didn't even give me a chance to explain before they were completely disabled my account, all of them. It didn't even give me a reason of what post that they found that to be not following community guidelines. So I haven't had any access. I haven't had any response of why. The only thing that I can think of is that I reposted a story. My niece tagged me on a story for my birthday, and it was a story that we had a picture from a Snapchat filter where we're both like the little Draculas with the little Dracula teeth. And she's little, I'm next to her, we're fully clothed, and she just said, happy birthday, Tia, I love you. And I reposted that story on my birthday because she was just giving me a shout out for my birthday. That is the only thing that I think AI must have gotten confused, that I was abusing a minor, which is truly disgusting, the accusation that they did. I mean, they're basically accusing me of being a pedophile. this is me assuming that it's something that I had posted that day on my birthday, because I honestly have no idea. I appealed on June 13th. They didn't specify what I needed to share, but I've been writing to them. At the beginning, it was daily. I mean, I don't exist. I cannot even anything. I don't, username not found. I have lost touch. I have lost contact with, you know, people that you keep in touch through social media, especially because I had an injury that I was bedridden the entire summer. All I had was the tools, which is social media, enabled for me to even reach out to clients, family, friends. It's just so embarrassing because people ask me what happened to your social media, and for me to say I was accused of being a pedophile, it's extremely embarrassing. It's a disgusting accusation, especially when they haven't even given me a chance to correct, or they haven't even told me what triggered it. Been the worst summer in business. I need people to be able to reach me if they wanna, you know, do business, and they can't. I have no exposure to the world. It's been two pay periods already. And it's everything. It's a combination of, you know, my income, my mental health. It is extremely frustrating to be accused of something and not be able to defend yourself. It's affecting my pockets. It's affecting the way that I reach out to clients or they can reach out to me. I just want my life back.
WLRN emailed Instagram's parent company, Meta, after speaking with Gigi and reviewing her evidence. 25 hours later, Gigi checked her email.
I had just finished doing a guided meditation because it was really early in the morning. And I said, okay, what is happening? And I clicked on it and I was like, wow. I just received a couple of emails, both from Facebook, not even Instagram, saying that they have reinstated my accounts and now my accounts are visible. They never explained what happened, what had caused anything. It's like completely gaslighted, like it never existed. Like that email saying that I was accused of something so gross and disgusting, it like never happened. And it's truly upsetting. I'm still waiting for that closure that I know I'm never gonna get. I feel like I wouldn't have been able to get my accounts back if it wasn't for you, honestly. So I just felt extremely grateful and thankful. And also, I felt like I was finally back catching up with work stuff. It was just nice to feel part of the world of real estate, which is all through social media, really.
Gigi Coloma in Miami is just one of countless Instagram users who have complained about the platform kicking them off, accusing them of child exploitation, only to have their accounts restored and given no explanation or apology. I'm Tom Hudson.
Well, starting Monday, the Florida Public Service Commission will hold what could be a two-week-long hearing on a proposed base rate settlement for Florida Power and Light. FPNL and numerous groups and businesses reached agreement in August on the proposal, but the State Office of Public Counsel, which is designated by law to represent consumers on utility issues and other consumer groups, opposed the proposed settlement. That settlement would lead to base rate increases of $945 million in 2026 and $766 million in 2027, according to the utility. FPNL would also collect additional amounts in 2028 and 2029 for solar energy and battery storage projects. Base rates make up a major part of customers' monthly bills, along with costs such as power plant fuel. Andrew Sutton is an FPNL spokesman.
This settlement agreement is a win for FPL customers and a win for the state of Florida. It's going to enable us to make the critical investments we need to make to continue to deliver the exceptional service our customers have come to expect, while keeping bills low through the end of the decade.
If the proposed settlement is approved, FPNL says the average customer will see rates go up about $2.50 per month beginning in January and continue increasing each year through 2029. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, people of all ages are heartbroken over Dr. Jane Goodall's passing this week. As WUSF's Jessica Mazaros reports, the legacy of the animal behavior scientist and peace advocate will live on through local chapters of her youth group, Roots and Shoots.
The main message of Roots and Shoots is that every one of us makes a difference every single day.
That's Jane Goodall speaking on a promotional video. She was well known for her groundbreaking study of chimpanzees before expanding her focus to advocating for human rights, animal welfare, and environmental protection. She inspired countless people around the globe, including St. Petersburg teacher Rachel Pathay.
She has given me so much purpose to help children see how they can make a difference, that they are empowered.
Pathay has been facilitating Roots and Shoots projects for 11 years. A few of Pathay's students recently made art therapy boxes for kids dealing with anxiety and stress. And just last week, a handful of the young environmentalists asked a state legislative delegation to protect Florida watersheds by increasing native plants. Last year, on International Peace Day, Pathay got to personally hand Goodall a card signed with messages from her students.
So one of them is Chloe, and she wrote that there can be peace if I remind people that the power of love is stronger than the love of power. You know, when I read words like this, then I truly see through them the reflection of Dr. Jane Goodall.
Goodall died of natural causes in California while on a speaking tour. She was 91. I'm Jessica Mazaros in Tampa.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Megan Bowman, Douglas Saul, Derek Cam, Tom Hudson, and Jessica Mazaros. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.